welcome to the Living Waters Church podcast.
Well, good evening. Tonight is a bit different because Doug said this morning we had the kids' Christmas production, which was an absolute blast. Nobody cried on stage or fell off the stage or anything like that, so that was really good. But how many kids were involved? Do we know off the top of our heads this morning? There was almost 90 children on the stage. And so it's always interesting, but it went really, really well. It was excellent. And if you missed that, maybe next year you can join us. But tonight is a bit different. As you know, we're in our series called Gift, looking at the gift that we get, the gift that we give, and the gift that we are. And tonight is going to sort of dovetail with that series, but it's really for your ears only. As this morning we celebrated with the kids, there wasn't a message or a sermon. But tonight there is a bit of one. And so I've been giving thought, deep thought, last week and this week, to what we might share together tonight as we are right in the thick of December, moving towards the 25th, and to sort of ask a bit of a question. How are we orienting ourselves around the Christ child in the manger this Christmas season? And we're going to look at that in a little bit of a different way this morning as we consider some of the characters of Christmas and perhaps how we might relate to them, or maybe how we feel like we don't relate to them. For some reason, we love telling stories and listening to stories at Christmas. Stories matter to us all year long, but at Christmas, they are especially treasured, I think. Perhaps we love stories because they spark our imaginations, and at Christmas, we allow our imaginations to run wild. Perhaps we love stories because they take us to far-off lands and usher us into worlds that we might not ordinarily or possibly usually care to enter. Perhaps stories present to us characters and themes that we find humorous or intrepid or impossibly brilliant or wicked, and so we're wary of them, or sometimes we're drawn to them as well. As I said, at Christmas, it seems, this is the time of year that we love stories the most and love to tell stories and experience stories the most. We'll tell scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago, says one of the Christmas songs we love to sing. Central, it seems, to all great stories are great characters. Captain Ahab, Wendy Darling, Long John Silver, Bilbo Baggins, Peter Rabbit, Sherlock Holmes, Bella Swan. No? Yeah, some of you are like, I don't know about that one. We find in these characters both alien and familiar virtues. Some seem strange and distant. Some maybe even dangerous. But other characters seem familiar. And we feel like at times we might even catch a glimpse of them in the mirror in the morning, if we really think about it. Christmas stories are full of great characters. Frosty, the tragically mortal snowman, doomed to an icy continuum of reincarnation each December snowfall. Rudolph, the horribly deformed reindeer, whose previously hideous abnormality saves Christmas for everyone. The Nutcracker's Mouse King, fending off animated toy soldiers to Tchaikovsky's brilliant musical backdrop. Dr. Seuss's nasty green hermit, the Grinch, who not only detests Christmas, but is bent on its ruin for the neighboring community. Buddy the Elf, what's your favorite color? St. Nicholas, who did, though we can't be sure exactly what, something meaningful, something powerful, to ignite a fire of Christmas morale that many of us warm ourselves by every December. One of my favorite Christmas characters is one who plays second fiddle in my mind alone to Santa Claus, and that is Ebenezer Scrooge. Charles Dickens' description of our favorite Christmas villain is wonderfully vivid. Dickens writes this: "Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained, and as solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, no wintry weather could chill, no wind that blew was bitterer than he, no falling snow was more intent upon its purpose, no pelting rain less open to entreaty. Foul weather didn't know where to have him. Many of us love A Christmas Carol and the many forms that it's taken over the years. I love A Christmas Carol because of Dickens' intent in the story. Disturbed by the heartless ill will towards the poor in his city, he chose to write a disturbing story, but thankfully a redemptive one. So Scrooge is an exaggeration. He's a caricature of all the disinterest inside of us towards the goodwill in the world. No one's quite as horrible as Scrooge, but we all know people who lack charity or cheer towards their fellow man. And we may notice such behavior in ourselves more often than we'd like. And so Scrooge, as repulsive as he is, becomes a vehicle for us each year to explore again the dark corners of our hearts and allow the surrounding cast of spirits and mortals to aid in warming us again to the ideas of goodwill, hope, life, kindness, and the true meaning of Christmas. All of these stories and all of these characters emanate from one story, however, one that we choose to celebrate this time of year in particular. Pagan rituals were redeemed. December was chosen for multiple reasons, ranging from the political to the scriptural. Traditions have been handed down from generation to generation, and we choose each year to remember and celebrate the story of the birth of Jesus, and most of us go all out. When I was little, every 24th of December, my parents would tuck me in on Christmas Eve after the festivities. But before I'd go to sleep, they read two stories to me. The first was the original Christmas story surrounding the birth of Jesus as told in the Bible. And then we'd move on to 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, otherwise known to childhood Luke as the Good One. I was usually eager for Christmas morning, and despite my parents' best intentions, at that point on Christmas Eve, most of my attention was on the arrival of the fat man in a red suit and the gifts that he brought. So naturally, I'd be more interested in pondering sleighs and reindeer over mangers and exhaustive genealogies. As a child, I was willing to accept both stories, though. One was myth and one was truth. But growing older, I shed interest in one and became more enamored with the other, obviously. Though I still love to celebrate any story whose character or theme promotes generosity and goodwill. So as an adult, I am clear on the fact that some Christmas characters are robed in lore and others are historically sound. I must admit that my consideration of the characters we find in the original Christmas story can be lacking some years. I admit that sometimes I give them little attention beyond a place on the mantelpiece. I'm not confused about Christmas, but when shepherds and Grinches grow up together in one's mind, one might struggle to view the historical persons accurately or take them seriously. As we noted previously, there are many Christmas characters, and we may find ourselves easily relating with them. They're designed that way. It's how we teach children moral stories and how we remember important details about the roots of Christmas. But lost in the shuffle, I fear, are many of the characters we find in the original Christmas story. Lacking illumination beyond many lights, the truth about them is often hidden in ancient darkness. Perhaps in part it's because these characters may not seem as accessible or as relatable as the ones that we fabricated. They're Middle Eastern. They're primitive. They're legendary. They're famous. They're players on a stage that we weren't destined to grace. How could we possibly understand them, let alone associate with them? They're distant, often not as vividly illustrated as many mythical Christmas characters. And on top of that, they're sacred, aren't they? Are we? Tonight, I want to invite you to allow yourself to relate to some of the original Christmas characters. These were real people, real ordinary people with families and jobs and stress. They loved, they hurt, they weren't lacking faults. And at times they were afraid, but at times they were valiant. They were much like you and they were much like me in many ways. In fact, the funny thing is they're actually the most relatable characters in all of Christmas storyland because they're actually real. And if you look closely, as we said, you might see one or two of them in the mirror in the morning. And so we begin with an old, washed up, dried up priest on his last legs, all ready to wind life down. Zacharias. Zacharias was the elderly father to John the Baptizer, who was the first prophet to his people in a long time. Zacharias had less faith in God than Mary did, and for a lesser miracle. He learned a lesson and named his son what God had instructed him to in humble obedience. And you might think that you'd believe God or in God if he sent an angel to talk to you. Zacharias didn't. And we'd probably find an excuse to mistrust God too. In fact, we probably all have in some way, shape, or form. God's taking an interest in me. I'm past it. I'm washed up. What good am I? What could God use me for? And how? A lack of faith or perspective, perhaps. He learns his lesson. And the lesson is that you're never too old or too young, as we'll find out later, to be useful to God. You're never washed up. Elizabeth, his wife, Liz the Happy, I think I would title her, the one who never thought she'd have a baby or lose the shame that she bore, an old woman who knew how privileged she was to be a part of the great story, to be John's mother. Elizabeth, the thankful one, the one who had been given so much, who had been given hope at the very last moment, and who responded with gladness and joy. God had come through for Elizabeth. It wasn't over for her. She looked finished, an old woman with no children, barren, shamed by her culture. Yet God sewed her story into his story, bringing her joy in more ways than she could have possibly ever asked for. God did more for Elizabeth than she could have imagined. And in her very last chapter, when she'd likely given up hope for years and years, and then God enters. Mary, a teenager. What would Mary have been like if she'd lived today? Would she go to high school? Would she listen to loud music from glossy boy bands with overly gelled hair? Would she text during class? Would she help out around the house occasionally? Mary was young and poor, likely younger and poorer than many of us picture her or paint her. Insignificant in the great big world and well aware of it, plucked, it would seem, from obscurity to play a key role in the biggest story ever. Faced with a big problem, pregnant and unmarried, a serious cultural shame and crime in her day, most likely misunderstood by her community, but stood by at least one man who took a risk to risk his good name. Mary, the obedient, faced with a task from God, She knew the immediate consequences and implications of her obedience. Mary the brave, the valiant, the strong. Mary the chosen, the upheld, the favored one. Mary, the character faced with a choice to say yes to God and see beyond the here and now and into what he was going to do through her for her future people. Mary the selfless. How much would have that giant task have weighed on Mary? Was she ever afraid? Was she ever nervous or doubtful? Mary was thrust into the limelight. It would seem that she had been selected for a role that she didn't audition for. And yet she was the girl for the job, asked to play the lead when no one would understand what she'd truly been called to act out. Might she have ever felt alone? How often would she recall the promise that she heard and the title that she had given to her, highly favored? Is this what God's favor looks like? Some of us have asked that question. Mary was invited, though, into the bigger picture, and she responded with a yes. Not too young, not too poor, not too obscure to be useful to God. In her time, a mere child and a woman with little rights or clout, a non-person back then, Mary became unexpectedly important. Joseph, her betrothed husband. All we're told about Joseph is that he was a good man. Unwilling to cause further shame or punishment for his future bride, he had every right in his culture to tear that family and girl apart, but he didn't. Eventually, he became a man of faith and trust and equal obedience to Mary. Joseph knew what he was getting into. We're often amazed at Mary and her trust, but as every good father in the room knows, kids don't just change a mother's life, they change a father's life too. Joseph was making a massive life decision in choosing to marry Mary. He spent his early years of fatherhood on the run, a refugee, sacrificing comfort and safety for his bride and her baby, a child who wasn't his. Joseph, when faced with a call to manhood and sacrifice to righteousness and trust, responded. He didn't run. He didn't hide. He didn't pass the buck. Joseph did the right thing and with God's aid played another key role. The angels. Hard to relate to? Choir masters, I like to think of them as. I think that we could learn a lot from angels. They've seen the glory of God. They reflect it. They remind us of the great joy we might have and refuse to hold back their praise and proclamation of the truth and joy that we find in God. I would describe them best as live karaoke creatures performing one function designed to sing along with. The shepherds. In a word, outsiders, culturally and religiously excluded from everyday society, mistrusted and hailing from the wrong side of the tracks, no one thought much of shepherds. One would think not to invite them to celebrate the birth of a king, and those similar to their social status these days wouldn't be invited into the maternity ward of Kate Middleton. It just wouldn't happen. No ruler today would invite the class of shepherd today that we find in our society in. Not much has changed. Shepherds were forbidden even to give testimony in law courts for concern about their integrity. People thought them liars and petty thieves. But they became the first apostles, the first messengers, the first testifiers of God's arrival on earth. Distrusted and excluded by everybody except God. Shepherds had a reputation for stealing and telling story, fibs even. But shepherds became witness to and were entrusted with the truest and most important message the universe had to offer. Accepted by God, invited by God, living metaphors at the Nativity, the shepherds welcomed in a way one of their own, the Good Shepherd, a reminder that outsider is a word lost on this newborn king. The Magi, or wise men, scientists, astronomers, mystics, spiritualists, pagans, astrologers, Capricorns, maybe, I don't know what they were, chosen by God to play a part in the story. God lets people in very early on who conservative religious types would likely hold at arm's length. But God and his plan for mankind is for mankind. And God will speak how he likes, through books or prophets or stars, and to whom he likes, to junkies or farmers or scientists, or your uncle who doesn't trust organized religion, or Stephen Harper for that matter. These men were on a quest. Something important had happened. Someone important had happened, and they couldn't quite put their finger on it. A long journey of sacrifice with a destination that was unknown to them when they set off. They bravely chose not to ignore what they knew to be important. They made a trek towards God, though not fully knowing it or knowing him even. They risked, and in the end they shielded the child they sought for. They were on his side and found themselves a part of the story that we remember today. What a cast. What a varied bunch. Old priests to grubby herders to scientists to angelic beings to teenage girls, all welcomed to play a part, make some of our modern tales look rather tame. But I've left a couple of characters out. I want to talk about them for a second. The first character is a character that we'd rather not mention, but every Christmas story needs a villain. And as I've been thinking through these characters over the past couple of weeks, as we approach Christmas together, I found myself actually identifying most with a man whose madness defined him and whose actions horrify us today. Herod, the original Scrooge. As I've been thinking about these characters, I find myself connecting with him for some reason. Herod the Great. As removed from antiquity as we are, you get the feeling that even if he didn't name himself the Great, he certainly didn't mind being called it. He ruled with an iron fist as best he could. He built palaces and theaters and aqueducts and fortresses and cities, wrote his name on walls. But he was also Herod the Delusional. History tells us that he murdered members of his own family to hold on to his throne. It seems that he'd stop at nothing to control. He's credited with the infanticide of Bethlehem's sons, of which the Holy Family barely escaped. Herod the Greatly misguided. His actions would lead us to believe that he lived for power, respect, and fame. Faced with the arrival of another king, the true king, Herod did everything to hold on to his power, including killing babies. Faced with the surrender and the inevitability of a greater power and story than his, Herod, for me, is a metaphor for the inner man I wrestle with daily. A man who wishes to be king. A person who wishes to control and will do everything to hold on to his crown. A delusional man at times, unaware of a bigger picture beyond his own life. a man capable of terrible things, a man faced with the arrival of Christ in his land, but a rejecter of him. Herod's story ended tragically. He died a king, a crazy king, out of his mind, of a tiny slice of land in the world, and missed surrendering to the king of everything. He is a footnote, and a negative one at that, to the great king, Jesus. I am glad that my trajectory is different than Herod's, that your trajectory can be different than Herod's. Though there may be at times a little Herod in my heart, and maybe he's more noticeable at Christmas, I'm glad that my story and your story can be a redemptive one. One last character, the central one, of course, a baby in a manger, the Christ child. Though predicted by prophets and kings hundreds of years before his birth, a baby couldn't have been a more unexpected character in the center of the story. That God would humble himself and become a child is the great wonder and mystique of Christmas. It was unfathomable to the people at the time where Jesus lived, and it's still hard for us to swallow and understand today. God is bigger than a baby. What is he doing here? This character development shakes up our paradigms and turns our worlds upside down. However, or from wherever each of us approach the manger, we are forced to reorient ourselves each year around the central character, because God's love and demonstration of goodness through Jesus throws us, all of us, for an absolute loop. Through the arrival of a baby, the old are informed they've got life in them yet and are useful in the plans of their Creator, not quite ready to be put out to pasture. The young are told that they matter, and though seem to hold no power, are invited to join in, and they're given great responsibility. This is an inspiring subplot to me, especially in a society where less and less is being expected from young people. God doesn't see it that way. He expects and endows more. The outsider becomes an insider. The excluded become included. And we're all reminded that God loves without prejudice or favoritism. The genuinely concerned people about their meaning, existence, and purpose in life are given hope that there is some order, there is some meaning, there is some purpose to everything. There is some light, some reason, by a light, a hint, the guiding of a star. Upon considering these characters, and maybe more that you're conjuring up that surround the story of Christmas that we find in the Gospels, we come to just a brief conclusion. I want to leave you with this question. How are you oriented to the child this Christmas? How will you respond to him in light of his invitation to you to be a part of the story and to play a role? At the center of every great story, as we said, are great characters. Let's find ourselves in the story and not miss out on the chance to advance the plot of God in our lives this Christmas. Felt that very strongly as I was preparing this week, that it's important for Living Waters this Christmas to understand the power of the story that we tell and display in a million different ways, and to understand where we fit into it. If you've never considered the baby in a manger deeply, if you've never related to one of these characters that we've walked through at Christmas, I encourage you to do that somehow in this way. Some of us genuinely do feel like shepherds on the outside. Others of us are searching. Others of us feel old and insignificant and sick and worn out. Others of us feel too young or unuseful to God. And everything we read in the Christmas story would say that those things are not the case. You can experience Jesus as these people did this Christmas, and I encourage you this December to move towards him as each of these characters did, actively. We're going to close with a prayer together. So if you'd stand with me, it'd be great. I don't know how many cookies you ate, but there might be more left over. So please don't rush off. Hang around. Spend some time with each other. Maybe chat about what we've just shared. How does this connect with you? As you know, there'll be more notes online to connect with it if you want to keep going with this teaching. But I encourage you this Christmas to spend some time with these characters and with this story. It's rich. And I can guarantee you're going to find yourself in it. Let's pray this all together aloud, nice and slow. Come, my light, and illuminate my darkness. Come, my life, and revive me from death. Come, my physician, and heal my wounds. Come, my flame of divine love, and burn up the thorns of my sins, kindling my heart with the flame of your love. Come, my King, sit upon the throne of my heart and reign there, for you alone are my King and my Lord. Amen. God bless you. Have a great rest of your evening and Merry Christmas.